Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jonah Hunt, appearing for Fagosa Lakes Property Owners Association. Registration number is 34379. Apologize, I've got a little bit of a sore throat. This is a unique case. The genesis of this case is a $400 fine in a homeowners association. You may be surprised that this case is now up to the Court of Appeals, but the case is extremely important, not only to Pagosa Lakes, but to other homeowners associations throughout the state. Virtually every community that has covenants of record has a nuisance provision that is, if not identical, substantially similar to the covenant that was deemed to be vague or ambiguous by the trial court in this matter. In this particular case, Mr. Polson was fined $400 after a hearing before the board of directors for a litany of objectionable behavior. It wasn't Mr. Polson himself personally, but it was his renters. So Mr. Polson rents short-term rentals, people come in for the weekend or the week. It's a rather large home, sleeps 26, and for whatever reason, Mr. Polson's tenants don't behave themselves. I don't know if it's a matter of, the renter's not having the right information, or, I really don't know what the reason is for it. That being said, the fine was levied, Mr. Polson paid it, and then he sued the association and tried to say that the nuisance covenant was vague. He also alleged that the rules and regulations which supplement the covenants were vague and ambiguous as well. We would submit that the covenant itself is not vague or ambiguous, and to assert that the rules and regulations which supplement the covenants, to assert that those are vague and ambiguous, we don't believe there's any basis in fact for that kind of argument. We cited some of the rules, that basically delineate all of the objectionable behaviors that would constitute a nuisance. So when you read the rules in conjunction with the covenants, it's actually a very specific framework as far as if you're an owner, you know that if you do X, Y, or Z, that you're going to get a letter and you're going to get fined after notice and opportunity for a hearing. And that's precisely what happened here. For whatever reason, the trial court granted summary judgment in favor of Mr. Polson without holding a hearing. Now, under the cases that we cited in the opening brief as well as the reply brief, we believe that is a reversible error. There were issues of contested material fact, and there's ample case law authority that would suggest that not having a hearing on such a matter is reversible error.
Excuse me, counsel. Let me clarify your position on that. As I understand it, the association did not file a cross motion for summary judgment, or at least I'm not aware of one. Is that true?
That's true. They filed a motion to dismiss, but no motion for summary judgment.
Right. So the trial court was in a position where only one side was saying that the covenants were ambiguous.
Right.
It's the association's position that the trial court was required to hold a trial then, correct, on meeting of the,
right.
So the provisions?
Our position is that it's kind of a layered test, if you will. Basically, if the covenant is not vague or ambiguous, then it's enforced. If it is vague or ambiguous, then the court is to look at the intent of the covenants and then decide whether the association enforced the covenant reasonably, which kicks in to gear the business judgment rule, which is codified in statute and is also provided for in the case law that we cited in the briefs. So the association, even if a covenant is deemed to be vague or ambiguous, the association at that point then still gets to present their case to the court. And that's not what happened here.
Well, let me ask you, there's a case called, I'm forgetting who the other party's name is right now, but Lazy Dog, which is a Colorado Supreme Court case that talks about determining the meaning of ambiguous terminology in a deed, or determining, in fact, in the first instance, whether language is ambiguous. And the Supreme Court indicated that extrinsic evidence should be admitted to determine, first of all, what the parties' interpretations were and whether it was ambiguous or not. Can you speak to that, please?
I would agree, Your Honor. I think that to the extent that the trial court thought that the covenant or the rules were ambiguous, it should have received evidence, it should have received testimony from principally the complaining parties, who in this case weren't any member of the board of directors. These were the neighbors of Mr. Polson, who've been putting up with this for months and years. So essentially, the association was not allowed to present the evidence and present the testimony to justify its actions which would have been protected under the business judgment. So by entering summary judgment, we believe that that's reversible, and I think that's supported by the Woodward case specifically. Now, Mr. Polson, both in the trial court and in the court, this court, argued that the Allen case basically was controlling precedent. I don't believe that to be the case. They're relying on the Allen case dealt with an architectural restriction, not a use restriction. And we believe that is a salient point for the court to consider. Moreover, the Woodward case and the Glen Eagle case were decided after the Allen case. In those cases, basically reiterate what I just stated to the court, which is if the covenant is deemed to be vague or ambiguous, the court then needs to look at the intent of the covenants, and it needs to hold a hearing and receive evidence and testimony as to whether or not the association was reasonable and enforced. The Allen case didn't apply those principles, and those principles trace back to the Rue versus Cheyenne Homes case, which I believe was cited in 1969. So we believe that the trial court essentially relied on the wrong precedent in granting summary judgments.
Can I just clarify something you said earlier? You said the distinguishing fact, or at least one of them, with Allen was that that was an architectural restriction as opposed to a use restriction. Is that significant?
Well, I guess you can look at it two ways. Mr. Polson, in his answer brief, argued that Woodward and Glen Eagle should be disregarded because they were architectural. They dealt with architectural restrictions rather than use restrictions. If that's the case, then Allen versus Steele should be disregarded as well. Then what are you left with? You're left with Rue versus Cheyenne Homes, which still applies the principles that Woodward did, you know, 5 years ago, I suppose.
So do you agree that because these other cases that we're dealing with architectural restrictions, they should not be applicable to this situation?
No, not at all, Your Honor. But we just wanted to point out the irony that, or the contradictory position that Mr. Polson was taking in his briefs to the court, which is he tried to distinguish the cases based upon an architectural versus a use restriction, when in fact the precedent that he's relying on, the Allen case, also dealt with an architectural restriction rather than a use restriction.
Thank you.
So in the Allen versus Reed case, which I take it you do not agree with and believe was wrongly decided, is that fair?
Well, I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. I think perhaps it should have limited application, at least as to this case.
Okay. So, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
To me, it seems completely contradictory to the later decided cases. So, but yet, neither of those cases mentioned the Allen case.
There in that case, the architectural dispute involved the definition of the meaning of one story, and it ended up being reversed. And here we're talking about the meaning of nuisance, mm-hmm. which is the use restriction. Do we have similar kinds of definitional problems as to what's meant by nuisance, kind of like what's meant by one story?
I don't think so, Your Honor. In our reply brief, we pointed out that the common law nuisance claim in the cases that have developed that body of law use the exact same terms that are in the covenant for Pagosa Lakes. You know, offensive, objectionable, these kind of, you know, general terms. The concept of a nuisance is going to be inherently subjective. There is no, I don't think, you know, what's a nuisance to one person may vary as to the person down the street. That's why courts need to have trials on a nuisance claim. Again, the court needs to hear testimony, needs to receive evidence, and needs to make a determination after it's done so.
And I suppose that, to go back to the earlier point that you made, that's precisely why we're here over a $400 case, is because it's inherently subjective. Mm-hmm. And this is a vacation rental, and they don't want to be hit with it, an inherently subjective term over and over and over again on their fines. So aren't they entitled to clarification as to what's meant?
Well,
precisely by nuisance?
I think it is defined in the rules. You know, the rules supplant the covenant, and they specifically define the behaviors or actions that are going to constitute a nuisance in the community. And Mr. Colson was guilty, if we want to say that, of multiple infractions that are set forth specifically in the rules. Now, you know, it should be noted that Mr. Colson bought into the community on record notice of these covenants, and he agreed to act in a reasonable manner in using his property, and that also extends to his guests or his renters. So for him to then, after the fact, try to argue, well, I don't understand what this means, it shouldn't apply to me, we don't believe that that's proper, and we don't believe there's any precedent in Colorado to allow that. So I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Josh Mack, and I represent Darrell Colston, the appellee in this matter, registration number 37858. This case is the simple application of Colorado's rule of strict construction of restrictive covenants. The rule of strict construction dictates that when interpreting an unclear covenant, all doubts must be resolved in favor of free and unrestricted use of property. Vague covenants that are susceptible to more than one meaning are unenforceable when applied in this manner. This case arises out of an enforcement action of the Declaration of Restrictions and the Neighborhood Rules and Regulations of the Pagosa Lakes Property Association. The notice of violation in question contained four alleged violations. Too many cars being parked in a cul-de-sac, lights being left on at night, trash overflowing a poly cart, and excessive noise. While none of these violations are violations of specific terms of the rules and regulations, they were all brought under the nuisance provisions of the declaration and the rules. Now, the nuisance provisions, in the rules at least, do forbid a few specific activities. For instance, they forbid construction after 8 p.m. They forbid shooting firearms in the neighborhood. However, they also contain a provision that forbids any activity that interferes with the peaceful use and enjoyment of other lots. This broad, undefined, and completely subjective prohibition clearly violates the rule of strict construction. Furthermore, the limitations on issues of noise and light are defined in terms that are also completely subjective. The nuisance provisions disallow obnoxious glare. They disallow excessive noise. The problems with these rules become apparent when you actually try to apply them. How many cars parked in a cul-de-sac is necessary to constitute to interfere with the peaceful use and enjoyment of other lots? Does a certain light fixture emit obnoxious glare? Does it matter if it's on at 7 p.m., 9 p.m., 11 p.m.? Does a trash can being overfull interfere with the peaceful use and enjoyment of other lots in the area? And how much noise is excessive noise?
Well, counsel, this this prompts my question. I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Hunt, which is, in the Colorado Supreme Court, in its 1998 decision in Lazy Dog Ranch versus Telluride Ranch, indicated that you need to have a hearing with a, or a trial with extrinsic evidence to determine whether what the parties intended a land covenant to mean. And why isn't that ruling applicable here?
I think it's not applicable. I don't think it was cited by either party.
My
recollection.
It may have nevertheless be applicable, but.
My recollection of the case is that deals with an affirmative easement, not a restrictive covenant, which is a negative easement. So I don't believe the same test applies. You don't have the same tie goes to the homeowner rule with respect to affirmative easements that you do with respect to negative covenants that restrict the use of property.
And do you have anything you can cite me to that, that talks about the distinction you just raised between affirmative and negative easements?
Other than my general understanding that an affirmative easement grants a right to do something else on a piece of property that you don't have entitled to, and whereas a restrictive covenant limits your use to do anything you want on a piece of property that you have entitled to. I don't have a case for that, but I believe that is the distinction, and I believe that the restrictive covenant cases are clear that the strict rule of construction applies with respect to them, and the Lazy Dog Ranch case deals with an affirmative easement. So I think the rules are different.
Please expand. You're talking about restrictive easements being interpreted differently. What citation do you have for me about that?
Just that restrictive covenants are subject to the strict rule of construction. There's a whole line of cases that says that. We cite them throughout our brief. And that language is never used with respect to affirmative easements. With respect to affirmative easements, courts go as deep as they have to find the intent of the parties. With respect to restrictive covenants, courts say they either have to be clear on their face or they can't be enforced.
Why can't the case law that your opponent has cited apply to allow the trial court some tools for interpreting the meaning of the restriction here?
Well, I don't think it has no tools. I think that the court can look to other terms within the declaration and the rules to see if those provide hints about the
meaning. Well, how about applying a standard of reasonableness?
I think that the standard of reasonableness, first of all, we have to determine who's going to apply the standard of reasonableness.
The court, one assumes.
Their argument is not that the court should apply a standard of reasonableness. Their argument is that they should be able to do whatever, make the determination, and that their decision will then be granted the deference that it will only be overturned if it is unreasonable or arbitrary and capricious.
I understand that you disagree with that, and I think I understand why. Why couldn't the court impose a reasonableness standard, objective reasonableness standard?
Because the strict rule of construction is the law in Colorado, and courts in Colorado have made the decision that the tie is going to go to the homeowner in those cases. I'd also argue that it's not a good thing from a policy perspective. Landowners should know what they can and cannot do with their property by looking at the declaration that comes in their title work when they buy a piece of property. They should not have to guess what's reasonable with respect to that.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. So, for example, if there are many different types of properties in a particular subdivision that's subject to such a covenant, let's say in the cul-de-sac where your client lives, there could be 10 cars parked without interrupting someone's fair use and enjoyment, someone else who lives in the cul-de-sac, whereas in somebody else's, it could only be 3. So why do they have to be so specific that your client would know he gets 10 and somebody else only gets 3?
Because it's more important for property owners to know what they can and cannot do with their property than it is for associations to be able to fine homeowners for minor annoyances. That's the policy that's clearly stated in the cases that describe the strict rule of construction. That's the policy that's been adopted by our courts, and I think it's sound. When you consider the slippery slope to being fined for all sorts of things that you didn't know were violations if you go down the reasonableness road.
Counsel, wouldn't that require then that any restriction have an exhaustive list of all the specific things that could violate the covenant in order to be enforceable under your interpretation?
I think it has to be a list. I think it has to be understandable, but I don't think it necessarily, well, I guess it does have to be exhaustive, but I don't think it needs to be overly burdensome. In this case, it would not have been hard to put into place regulations that forbid the activities that Mr. Polston is accused of. You could have a limitation on number of cars parking in the staff, perhaps. You could have a limitation on the kinds of light fixtures you allow, wattage, number of light fixtures, what time they're allowed to be on. You could have restrictions on say, stating that you cannot overfill a trash can, such that you can't close the lid. Many HOAs do. This is not an impossible thing to do, and what I'm saying is that the burden should be on the HOA to explain what is not allowed, not on the landowner to guess how the HOA will fill in the blanks later on.
And it's your position that there is no right to litigate that issue if the homeowner association did not spell it out sufficiently. For instance, the burden is not on you to go to trial and make the arguments at trial that you're making here, which is, you know, they didn't say how many cars we get on a cul-de-sac. Like, they didn't say what the wattage needs to be. They didn't say that the lid had to be up or down. It's not your burden to go to trial and make that argument.
I don't think we need to make that argument at trial because it's a legal issue. And that's why it was decided on summary judgment. That is not based on disputed facts. We are saying that if you want to have a limitation on how many cars that can be in the cul-de-sac, it needs to say how many cars can be in the cul-de-sac. And I think that the strict rule of construction clearly supports that. The association does not really argue that the nuisance provisions are not vague. They argue for a change in law, I believe a monumental change in law. They urge the court to discard the strict rule of construction in favor of a rule that allows for enforcement of any covenant, no matter how vague, so long as the enforcement is done reasonably. The association wishes to be appointed a trier of fact and law, invested with the level of deference that trial courts do not enjoy. The association cites a line of cases which were discussed, Ruby Cheyenne Homes, Woodward v. Tamron, and Glen Eagle Civic Association, that require prior architectural review of improvements. And they allow for some subjectivity in enforcement of these regulations. They argue that this dictates a reasonableness standard for enforcement of all covenants. The purpose of the strict rule of construction is to give landowners notice of what they can and cannot do with their property. The requirement of prior architectural review of plans is completely consistent with this. Because landowners submit their plans, and they get an up or down vote on those plans, and therefore they know whether or not they can proceed. This is entirely different from a subjective, after-the-fact enforcement action, subject only to the limitation that their decision not be arbitrary and capricious. To some extent, it also explains why we have these prior architectural review covenants. You cannot write an enforceable covenant that houses have to be pretty. Instead, what you can do is require prior review of plans so that you can have those sort of aesthetic determinations, but the property owners will know when they build the house whether they're permitted to build that house.
Counsel, excuse me, would you agree that to some extent the law of contracts applies to this type of covenant?
I think that the rule of strict construction is something that exists only with respect to restrictive covenants and does not apply generally to the law of contracts. I think that the initial on space determination would be the same as with the law of contracts. The idea that you look at the entire document, if you can possibly glean other information from other parts of the document, That's similar to the rule of contracts, but that's where the similarities stop.
Well, I think I know what your answer is going to be to my next question, which is the contract law imposes a duty of reasonableness, or in interpreting a contract, you have to interpret terms in a reasonable manner. In a manner, it can't be interpreted in a manner inconsistent with the reasonable expectations of the parties. So I think I know what your answer is, but why couldn't we apply that same rule here to these covenants?
Well, the rule of strict construction, to my knowledge, has never been applied to contracts. It's been applied in restrictive covenant cases. And I think the reason is this. Yes, admittedly, you do receive, you can go to the clerk and recorder's office and look at a copy of restrictive covenants when you buy a house. But you did not agree to that. You did not negotiate that document. That is an encumbrance on the property that comes with the property when you buy it.
That you're bound by.
Agreed, you are bound by it. You're
bound. I have actually seen people argue here that you have agreed to them by purchasing the property, and I think that there may be some support for that.
Well, I think that obviously there is such a thing as constructive notice. That's why restrictive covenants are valid. But I think that they're different. We have to recognize the fact that they are in fact different from contracts because people did not affirmatively bargain for them.
You can buy a property someplace else.
I think your options in that respect are limited.
I think they're unlimited.
not houses like this one. But that's not the point. The point is that restrictive covenants are not freely bargained for. In the real world, most people do not read the restrictive covenants that come with their house. They just assume that they're going to make sense and preserve their property values. They are not freely bargained for the way that contracts are freely bargained for. And I think that makes a difference, and that's the reason why we have case law that says ambiguous covenants cannot be enforced. Well, in closing, I would ask you to affirm the district court's ruling. I think it's a simple application of this rule, and I think that they're not entitled to that change in law.
As we noted in our briefs to the court, I think it's unreasonable for Mr. Polson to request that Ghost of Lakes, which is a volunteer nonprofit corporation in a rural county, that they impose scientific standards on lighting, sound, that kind of thing. These are all volunteer directors of the association. To try to delineate down to decibels and different types of luminance, meters, that types of thing. And these are volunteers. They are not going, no one's going to volunteer for the board if they're forced to do that. Plus, it would make managing the community virtually unreasonable and unmanageable in and of itself. As far as the comment the council made, we're not asking for a change in law from this court. The cases that we've cited are good law. Woodward and Glen Eagle were decided in 2007, 2008, which are later cases than the strict construction cases that Mr. Polson has cited. I do believe there's some tension there between the older line of cases which deal with the strict construction versus the more recent cases which state that covenants, you have to look at the intent, if they're deemed to be vague, and then you have to have a trial and determine whether or not they've been enforced reasonably or not.
Excuse me, counsel, can you respond to your learned opponent's comment that he thinks that lazy dog applies only to affirmative easements and not to negative easements, such as the one, negative covenants?
I'm not aware of any case law or statute that would support that distinction.
And how about the application of reasonableness law that applies to contracts being applied to covenants.
Yeah, covenants are quasi-contractual. They're different in some ways, but in many ways they're very similar. Mr. Polson bought into the community, and he's bound by the covenants. Whether or not he read them or not, the case law is quite clear. He took an in on notice, and he's bound by those contracts. So I guess in closing, what I'd say is that, you know, while these older cases state that covenants are to be strictly construed in favor of free use of land, that doesn't mean that an association can't regulate objectionable and offensive behavior in a community. I believe that using this hiding behind the strict construction argument to justify objectionable behavior in the community is not a legitimate argument or a credible argument to be made in this court. So we ask that the decision of the trial court be reversed and remanded. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your arguments, and an opinion will issue in due course.